next speaker is not a newcomer to some of you people. Dr. Randy Yonker has relatives in this area, and so he's not new to quite a few of you. But I've just recently become acquainted with him through the Adventist Theological Society, and I've enjoyed hearing him speak. He's got a lot of youth and vigor and enthusiasm, and I really appreciate it a lot. He's an associate professor of Old Testament and Biblical Archaeology at the SDA Theological Seminary. But I just heard that he will be getting his full professorship in June, I believe it is, and congratulations to you, Randy.
We're delighted to be here. We're very delighted to have you hosting the Adventist Theological Society. I'm a very gung-ho member. I enjoy working with Dick and John Baldwin. I heard part of Dick's presentation this morning. I was helping out with a youth, and I heard Dr. Baldwin's talk, and I'm going to be this afternoon following up a little bit on the stage that he set this morning concerning the geologic column. I'm going to talk for just a few minutes about challenges of the fossil record, and then we're going to invite you to ask questions, not that we have the answers necessarily, but at least to work with some of the issues, share with you at least what our impressions are. None of the three of us, as you can see, are really scientists. We're more coming out of the theology perspective. Dr. Davidson, Dr. Baldwin, myself are all very concerned about the issue of creation. Creationism, or creation, particularly belief in a six-day literal creation, a recent creation, is something that often has been assumed to be an integral part of Seventh-day Adventist understanding. Increasingly in some quarters, that understanding has been challenged. We can deal with that issue on two levels. We can deal with the scientific material, or we can deal with it from the biblical perspective. We've been dealing with it more from the biblical perspective. Dr. Davidson addressed the question, does the Bible really allow for creation to be expanded beyond that six literal 24-hour days? And Dr. Baldwin made reference to that as well. Our reading of the text suggests that that's not the case. The Bible itself does not allow us that much freedom. If it did, that would be fine. That might help us accommodate some of the scientific challenges. But those of us who have worked with the Hebrew text, Dr. Davidson outlined some of the presuppositional issues last night and some of the Hebrew and syntactical and grammatical issues. Those of us reading the text really feel that the Bible does indeed teach a literal six contiguous 24-hour day kind of a creation. The second thing that the three of us and several of our colleagues at the seminary as well are convinced of is that the Bible teaches a worldwide or a global flood. And again, I have wrestled with that issue myself. Is there any room for a local flood? I personally am convinced that the Bible writer did not intend to teach that. My colleagues have probably already pointed out there's several key words like Mabul that are used in the Hebrew that suggest the writer of the Hebrew text intended to the best way they could to describe a flood that covered the whole world. Even some great historical critical scholars like Von Rod and so forth, and Gunkel, when you read in some of their commentaries, they themselves will say that the Bible writer did intend to describe a worldwide, not a local flood. They just don't believe it, because the scientific evidence for them is so convincing. So if you're working from the position, what does the Bible say? I genuinely feel it does teach a literal six-day creation and a worldwide flood and a recent creation as well. We're not today going to get into the chronological issues. I'm an archaeologist by training, and I am very painfully aware of the challenges that we as archaeologists face. The Bible seems to suggest a recent creation of a few thousand years ago. Ellen White endorses that position as well. But when you look at the scientific evidence, when you look at the geologic column, when you look at radiometric dating schemes such as potassium, argon, uranium, lead, some of these things I know are going to be a little bit technical. We don't want to get too technical. But we have to admit there are a lot of very severe challenges. It does seem like the Earth has been here a lot longer. When you're looking only at the scientific evidence and looking at the way scientists interpret it, it does seem like the Earth has been here a lot longer. So we know we're going against the stream. The pyramids, early Egyptian civilization, that's more my bailiwick. It seems like those civilizations have been here longer, according to what conventional historians, you know, date them at, than what the Bible chronology seems to allow for. So we're not unaware of those challenges, and yet we still feel compelled by what the text itself says to us to defend a recent, literal creation position. So that makes us at odds with most of the world. It's not something we do lightly. It's not something we do with our heads in the sand. It's not something we do unaware of the challenges that are there. So I feel I need to, kind of give that a little bit of an introduction. The fossil record itself, Dr. Baldwin made to me what is probably the key theological concern a number of us at the seminary and throughout the church leadership are worried about moving to a position of, can we have long ages and believe in creation? Can we be good Adventists and, have our cake and eat it too, so to speak? And the issue he was trying to point out in his sermon this morning is that it's very difficult because of the existence of the geologic column. He pointed out, I felt very nicely this morning, and if you weren't here for this morning's presentation, what Dr. Baldwin is basically saying is, you've got places on the earth like the Grand Canyon. Underneath your feet when you're standing on the rim of the Grand Canyon are all these layers of rocks, these strata of rocks. And underneath your feet, there are all these dead organisms, dinosaurs, and many other types of organisms. There are all sorts of plants. They're dead. They're fossilized. They've been turned into a rock-like substance, lithified. And they are there, and they go down thousands and thousands of feet. They are dated radiometrically back millions and millions of years. As you follow that fossil chain up, the fossil record, the different kinds of animals, you've got trilobites, for example, down there at the bottom. You've got fish in the Devonian, kind of at the lower part. You've got dinosaurs higher up. You don't find any clear examples of human fossils. Now, we hear stories about, human beings being found contemporaneous with the dinosaurs. While that would be exciting, I haven't myself seen data that would show that to be the case yet. There are stories of footprints, and we're still investigating that, but as an archaeologist, I am not yet quite convinced that we can say that we have humans contemporaneous with the dinosaurs. So we have a problem as creationists, and we have to be honest. So far, the best human evidence isn't until you get to the top of that geologic column. And on the surface, it does therefore look like the evolutionists are right. It looks like, because you have the trilobites at the bottom, the dinosaurs in the middle. Humans don't appear until the top in terms of this geologic column. If the evolutionists are right, that would mean that about 570 million years ago, you've got trilobites at the bottom. They evolved into eventually all the way up to hominids and humans at the top. That would be the simplistic explanation there. If humans don't appear at the top and you're a Christian, and you're trying to accommodate the scientific evidence with your belief in a need for Jesus Christ as your personal Savior and that Jesus is coming again soon, you've got this theological problem. You've got death going on for at least 570 million years, and you could actually make the case for much more time than that if you get into the issue of Precambrian life, possibly. You've got all that life and death occurring before humans even appear on the surface of the earth, before Adam and Eve theoretically exist, before they fall, before sin occurs, and before the supposed death that's a consequence of sin comes into play. You've got all that death. It basically makes the Bible out to be contradicting itself. What you have, if the geologic column is true and it represents an evolutionary record, you've got death before sin. And for those of us at the seminary, this is a major theological challenge that can't be lightly ignored. As Dr. Baldwin pointed out this morning, if that is true, there really is no foundation for Christianity itself, in my opinion, let alone Seventh-day Adventism. It basically goes right out the door, because death then did exist before the fall. The historicity of the fall itself becomes questionable. Our need for Jesus Christ as our personal Savior becomes problematic. It becomes questionable, at least for me. There are some people that try and get around that, some theologians, but I have to admit I've listened to their arguments carefully. We can't go into all of them here, but I have not found them convincing. For me, if I'm going to be logical and rational, I would have to give up my faith. So for me, the challenge is extreme. It's a very important one. It's a very critical one. Now, well, what do you do with all that scientific evidence and for that geologic column? What do we say as creationists? I have to say right up again front, the answers are not easy ones. I agree with Dr. Baldwin that in a big picture, probably the best way of explaining the geologic column is through what we call flood geology. Saying that, I don't know this audience, I don't know who's in the audience, I want you to know we are aware that that is a kind of a simplistic way of answering the question. Just to say the flood did it all, I recognize, doesn't answer all of the challenges. There are a lot of complexities, some of you may be aware of, that are involved in the geologic column, its existence, that brought it into existence, that aren't easy to explain in a simplistic view of a worldwide flood. All I could say in a very general way here is that whatever nature the flood catastrophe was like, it probably was not a case of raindrops simply coming down gently, the water getting deep, and all of the animals drowning. That's how I was, thought of it as a child. You know, the water got deep and the animals drowned. But we have to recognize there were probably a lot of very complex geological phenomena processes going on at the time of the flood that are beyond the understanding of modern science. Even if we were to witness them, I'm not sure we could fully get a handle or appreciate the powers and the complexity involved in this process. So I think we have to recognize there's a very challenging, catastrophic process that's not easy to break down and analyze, particularly after the fact. I would also suggest that we don't believe that all of the fossils we see in the fossil record are necessarily the result of the flood. I think we have to allow for the possibility that between the fall in Genesis and the flood event, we don't know exactly how much time. The Bible chronology would suggest at least, possibly a couple thousand years from the original creation down to the flood, and it could have been a little bit more time. That there could have been catastrophes going on before the flood that killed some organisms, that some animals became extinct perhaps before the flood even came about. Sin was raging. The Bible says that sin had built to such a peak over, a few thousand year period before the flood came, that the whole world was full of chametz. It was full, we translate it often in English as violence. But the Hebrew word chametz, actually, it's related to a word you may hear when you listen to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. There's a group of people, a Palestinian group called Hamas. That's the Arabic word that's related to the Hebrew word chametz. And these people are dedicated to overthrowing the Israeli government by violence, terrorism. Okay, so you get the sense of the word. Okay, chametz means a type of blood shedding. That's what's implied in the word. So has God looked at the world? It had been so full of chametz, of blood shedding for thousands of years, that he felt he had to bring the flood. So many organisms probably during this period of chametz, of worldwide violence, contributed to the formation of our geologic column. How? What types of catastrophes? We don't know for sure. There were processes probably going on before the flood. Then the flood itself comes. That's the mother of all catastrophes, according to the Bible. Pardon Saddam Hussein. And then even after the flood, though, I think we have to allow that while the flood was a singular event, and we often think of it, the Bible itself describes the flood as a single year worldwide kind of event. I don't believe that the Bible requires that all the catastrophism that the world experienced quit at the end of the flood. I suspect that there were set into motion. The world was made unstable geologically, and that other processes, even though the flood basically closed down, the water started subsiding, it set into motion other geological processes, volcanism, probably continents were still moving, what they call orogeny, mountain uplift. Many of these processes probably continued on for not just a few years after the flood, but for centuries after the flood. In fact, I would suggest it's been millennia. It's still going on even to this day. We witness it every now and again in California when the earth shakes a little bit. I call these the belly aches, the residual belly aches of the great flood. It's not finished yet. So that since the flood, portions of the geologic column probably were created as well. Again, many different localized catastrophic phenomena going on. So again, I want you to understand that we aren't proposing a simplistic type of a model. In fact, I don't think any model proposed by a creationist adequately explains all the challenges yet. But that shouldn't stop us from having confidence in the fact that the event happened. What I would like to do for just a few minutes now, then for about 30 minutes, and we'll have some time maybe for some questions or responses or reactions, is to share with you about four or five areas of research that have been going on that to me give me some hope that we can understand the creation of the geologic column in a catastrophic sense, okay? The first of these examples, and I'm sure I don't have pictures. I will have pictures later on this afternoon for the archaeological stuff. But there is a interesting study that has been done by Dr. Clyde Webster. He is a research scientist, geochemist with the Geoscience Research Institute, Loma Linda University. This concerns some research he did with what are called uranium roll front deposits. My colleagues know about this because we talk about it in seminary quite a bit. What in the world are uranium roll front deposits? Uranium roll front deposits are a type of deposit that are formed down in the lower layers of the geologic column. We won't go through all the complexity. Certain ions of uranium and selenium percolate through some soft permeable rocks, and they form a special type of a uranium deposit called a uranium roll front deposit. The interesting thing about these deposits, they're found in the middle of the geologic column, and it is assumed by evolutionary geologists that it would take anywhere between 750,000 years. It's a lot of time, 750,000 years and 1.5 million years to create one of these roll front deposits, these uranium deposits, we'll call them for shorthand. Now think about that for a second. If that is true, what kind of a challenge does that pose for the creationist? Here you've got your geologic column, the rocks are stacking up. Right in the middle of that geologic column, you've got a peculiar type of a formation, this uranium roll front deposit that requires anywhere between 750,000 years and 1.5 million years, right smack in the middle of the column. You don't just have one of those, you have several of those types of deposits found at different places throughout the world. So what happens? You start the flood, then stop for 1.5 million years, create this deposit, then go on, so you have a, you know, a quick creation, lots of time in between, and then, you know, continue on with a rapid deposition of the column. You can see it's a problem. There's no room in biblical history for time out to form uranium roll front deposits. So Dr. Webster was perplexed by this problem. He wondered, does it really take that much time to form a uranium roll front deposit? So he thought he'd get a graduate student to work on an experiment, which he did at Loma Linda University. They tried to recreate as best they could the conditions that they were witnessing out in nature where these uranium roll front deposits were found. And they saw that you needed to have water, you needed to have sand, you needed to have selenium and uranium ions percolating through the sand. And he wondered how long, if you keep percolating these ions through, could you start forming an actual uranium deposit? So they created a glass tube, packed it with sand, ran the water and the ions through it. And they did this for some days and some weeks, and nothing happened. And, of course, the student was a little discouraged. He wasn't sure he wanted to wait around 750,000 years to see if it was going to happen or not, let alone 1.5 million years. And it was his graduate project. You know, it depended upon getting some results. Well, Dr. Webster assured him that even negative results were results, but let's give it a shot. Well, it didn't work. And then they started doing some more analysis of the deposits out in nature. And they noticed something that a lot of the scientists had overlooked, that wherever these uranium roll front deposits were found, there was evidence of organic material. Formerly living things that were now dead were always found in association with the sand, the water, and the various ions that went into making this uranium roll front deposit. So after trying this experiment with no success for some time, they decided to make up a new batch, but this time they just threw in some crushed vegetation, some organic material, and threw that into the recipe. And nobody had any idea what that might do. The scientific literature had no understanding that this had any importance at all. But they went ahead and added that to the mix, and they started repercolating through the sand, the water, and the selenium and the uranium ions. And what was interesting was after about 6 week time, they started noticing a red band forming in the glass tube. They did an analysis of it, and after more time, particularly after about 6 months, they realized they were forming a miniature uranium roll front deposit. They were able to do what science thought would take 750,000 years minimum to do, they were able to do in about 6 months' time. So now this, does this prove creation in a short age? No, not by itself. But it does force us as scientists to start thinking, questioning, do we have all the answers? Do all the processes that we now think we understand really occur the way we think they occur? Could there be some unknown factors that can make things happen more rapidly? then, you know, they appear to occur in nature. This suggests us as scientists to be a little bit more cautionary. Maybe Dr. Webster has the answer. I'm very optimistic. More research needs to be done. But it does teach me to be cautious about assuming it must take 750,000 years. If you can do it in the lab in 6 months, maybe it didn't take a million years or more. A second area of interest that to me raises some new information concerning the fossil record in the geologic column are turbidity currents. I didn't mention my background, I'm not sure, since I missed my own introduction, whether it was mentioned, I have a degree in biology as well. I have a master's degree in biology in addition to my work in archaeology. So I did spend a number of years in my early career running around in the western U.S. studying geology and paleontology. And one of the things I was interested in was a certain type of a deposit that you can find actually in places like the Grand Canyon. They were not originally recognized when I first started studying science in the 1970s. But in the mid-70s, they started recognizing these things, and I'll explain what they are in a moment. I'll back up and tell a little story. I forget the exact year, and I don't have my notes right in front of me, but there was a big earthquake off of the northeast coast of Canada in the region of Nova Scotia. Off the coast of that area, there's a, I believe it's called the Grand Banks. There's an underwater shelf. You have the water, but the ocean does not get very deep for some time. It goes out on what's called the continental shelf, and then it'll slip down and go down very deep to the deep ocean. Well, right in this Grand Banks area off of Nova Scotia, there was an earthquake. Now, I don't have a map, but basically this area of the shelf was running in a north-south direction. And this earthquake caused a lot of mud. It was all underwater, mind you. It caused a lot of mud to slide off the underwater shelf and go down into the great deep basin of the Atlantic Ocean. Now, they had 13 cables running between North America and England at that time. This was just after the Titanic sunk. I guess that's sort of a popular theme right now, the Titanic movie I'm hearing a lot about. This was just after that period of time. And there were these 13 transatlantic cables running across the bottom of the ocean floor. Well, when this earthquake happened, this mudslide started going. It was a tremendous amount of mud, and it started going faster and faster down the slope towards the bottom of the ocean. And it went for over 13 hours, and it went for many miles. They later calculated that this mudslide, I forget the total number of thousands of square miles it covered, but it was traveling at 50 miles an hour underwater. It caused a tremendous underwater mudslide. It actually bumped up and surrounded the Titanic itself that had, you know, already sunk. And as it was moving, it snapped every one of those 13 cables. And they could actually tell what was going on because people would be communicating between England and United States and Canada, and they would get cut off. And you know, the next cable would be a few miles away, and that thing was moving so fast it would knock that cable off. And in just a few hours, all 13 cables have been snapped. So they're able to tell this underwater current was moving along at least 50 miles an hour. Well, they can take a ship and go out and they can drill down to where these underwater mud flows are, and they can do samples of them. So they've pulled up cores of these underwater mud flows. They're called turbidity currents for turbid water, mud being in solution in the water, you know. And they've discovered that when this mud flows, it rotates in a very unique pattern, and when it settles out, it leaves a very distinctive pattern in the form of the grains, you know, big grains and small grains of mud being separated in a very distinctive pattern. And when they cored down, pulled these up, and looked at these cores of this mudslide and cross-section, they could see this very distinctive pattern of these mud flows. Well, then somebody got the bright idea. I wonder if you look at the mountains on land, or in the Grand Canyon, where we have a lot of deposition, can we see the same unique pattern of mud flow in fossilized rocks, in lithified rocks? And guess what? They did. As they went to certain formations in the Grand Canyon, a lot of the rocks that they assumed had formed slowly by just dirt, wind, you know, piling up slowly over millions of years, they realized that good hunks of the Grand Canyon and other major geological formations in the United States were actually formed by underwater mud flows. And in fact, this revolutionized geologic interpretation in the mid-70s. Everywhere geologists looked, they started seeing these turbidity currents. And that helped them realize that the geologic column, at least the actual depositional process, was not slow. Indeed, it was catastrophic and fast. In fact, this has made evolutionary geologists become, to a certain extent, catastrophists. That, to me, is a very significant discovery. Now, you may ask, well, now, do they all believe in Noah's flood? No. What they will do, because they are so driven by their presuppositions and the fact, you know, they don't see evidence for God, and they feel the only way to explain things is through an empirical scientific approach, what they'll do instead is say, okay, fine, maybe much of the geologic column or many of these formations were laid down very quickly. Turbidity current seems to prove that, but there must have been millions of years in between the flows. Okay, so they still believe that the geologic column is, hundreds of millions of years old. But at least it's a half step, maybe a baby step, in recognizing that there are evidences in the geologic column to show that that many of the rocks in the world were laid down fast and rapidly. So I think it's a step in the right direction. Another interesting, report that I've read in the last couple of years deals with fossil coral reefs. And by the way, most of this stuff is published in the magazine if you're interested. I hope they're still publishing it. I don't see anyone from geoscience here today, but it's called Origins. It's primarily for teachers in our colleges, but a lot of this information is there if you'd like to dig it up. It's from Loma Linda University. But they have found in many of the mountains in the United States great big piles, fossilized piles of coral material. Now that is interesting. You might think on the surface, well, what would coral material be doing in mountains in the United States? Doesn't that prove that the flood was up there? Well, it's not quite that simple. When scientists first found these corals up there, they looked at them and there was so much coral, it reminded them of a coral reef that grows underneath the ocean. Now, if you know much about coral reefs, the current understanding of coral reefs is that they take a long time to grow. They don't just grow in 1 year. And yet you've got these things throughout the geologic column. You've got these great big piles of coral in the geologic column. Did it take hundreds of thousands of years to grow those coral reefs? The evolutionists said, yes, you can't have coral reefs there unless they grew there naturally over hundreds of thousands of years. Well, closer examination of these coral reefs geologically revealed something very interesting. If you go into the ocean and core into an authentic coral reef, you'll see it has a very distinctive internal structure, the way it kind of grows and grows out. You can see the difference between the outside of a coral reef and the inside. There's very distinctive coral structures in there. When they started drilling into these fossil ones that were found in the mountains, they made an interesting discovery. They did not have the same structure inside. They were not coherent coral reefs. Instead, there was a lot of mud and broken pieces of coral all churned up on the inside. This suggests that these are not authentic coral reefs at all. Rather, they are corals that were destroyed and then transported and redeposited. That by itself would suggest that we don't have the problem with coral reef growth, at least in many of these cases, that instead that we have catastrophic deposition going on. And that, again, is another evidence that sections of the geologic column, we've got turbidity currents now, we've got other places with these big coral reefs, they were formed rapidly, catastrophically, not slowly, as we originally thought. Another interesting piece of research has been done by Dr. Leonard Brand from Loma Linda University. These things are all kind of interrelated. He was doing some research at the Grand Canyon, looking at the sandstones that make up much of the Grand Canyon and the geologic column. And the current thought when he started his research was that these big sandstone deposits, these strata of sandstone, were probably deserts on the United States way back millions of years ago, that the sand slowly blew in and deposited in a very gradual process, taking hundreds of thousands of years, if not more. Well, Dr. Brand noticed some interesting features in these sandstones. Were they laid down slowly on land over a long period of time, or could they have been laid underwater? The evidence for water deposition was rather interesting. He noticed that in many of the layers of sandstone, there were fossil footprints in the sandstone. I've seen these myself. And there's many different kinds of animals that made footprints in the sand. Well, that was kind of a curious feature. He wondered, well, how do you make a footprint in sand and preserve it so that people will, you know, see it, you know, millions of years later? Have you ever walked along a beach of dry sand and tried to leave a footprint that would fossilize? Think about that. I'm talking about dry sand now. Usually when you step in dry sand, what happens to your footprint? Yeah, it kind of, the sand collapses in on itself, and it leaves a little dent in the sand. depression, but you don't leave a nice distinctive footprint. And the ones he was seeing in the fossil record at Grand Canyon were beautiful, nice distinctive footprints. You could see the toes of the animal. In most cases, they were dinosaur types of animals, lizard type animals. And so he got to thinking, well, how would you get these fossil footprints preserved? Well, there's only one way to do that. And if you've walked along a beach, if you go off the dry sand closer, they have better integrity. You start having nice distinctive footprints. So he came up with the idea, perhaps these footprints were laid in wet sand. Well, when you start having wet sand, you have water, and that changes the whole environmental situation of what's going on. He tried a number of different types of experiments. Was this partially dry sand, partially wet sand? And he made another very interesting discovery. He made a little aquarium, and he didn't have any dinosaurs. Steven Spielberg had used them all for his movie, Jurassic Park. So he had to go and get some little tiny lizard, like reptile types of animals, which could simulate, he thought, the dinosaurs. And he put these little reptiles into a water tank, and there was sand in the bottom of it. And I should back up and mention one other curious thing about some of these footprints that Dr. Brand was studying. He would see places where the footprints were walking along, and then they stopped, and you'd go for a number of meters or quite a few feet, and then the footprints would pick up again. And then they would stop, no footprints for a while, and then suddenly the animal's walking again. Well, this is rather puzzling. What was the animal doing? It's sort of like, you know, going down a ski slope and seeing a tree and two skis, you know, and they go around the tree. How does he do that? Okay, the same thing with these footprints. They're walking along, and then the animal quits walking. Did it go to heaven for a while? Did it sprout wings and fly and then land again? How would you do that? Well, in this little tank, he noticed something. If he didn't make the water too deep, just deep enough so, you know, like the water is rising, and he drops the little lizard in there, what would the lizard do? Well, the lizard doesn't want to drown, so it kind of walk in its hind feet. The sand was underwater, it'd make beautiful little footprints, just like the ones he was finding in the Grand Canyon. And what the lizard would do is it'd kind of walk along, reaching its nose up above the water, trying to breathe, and then it would jump off, and it would swim for a little while. And then it'd get tired, and it would land again, and it would walk for a little bit more. And then it would try and jump up, and it would swim for a little while. And it made the same pattern across the bottom of the aquarium that they were finding in the Grand Canyon, across the sandstone. So he's done some publication. He's doing some research on this right now and shared this at some scholarly meetings. It's quite a debatable topic, but he's suggesting that these footprints were not laid in dry sand on land over long periods of time. Rather, it seems like there were water over the sand when these footprints were being formed. And what was even more interesting is that when they did a more careful analysis of the footprints, not only were they walking along, disappearing, and coming back, but there seemed to be evidence that there was a slope to the deposit. And the way the toes were depressed seemed to suggest that the creatures were going uphill. They were trying to go up, not down. Now, if you're trying to get out of water, you don't keep walking down deeper into the water. You're trying to walk out of the water. And there seemed to be evidence that all the footprints are going uphill, as if the animals were trying to get to shallower water so they could survive. So putting all these pieces together, it seems like there's a whole different environment for these. These footprints were formed. The sand was formed underwater. It was a situation where the water apparently was getting deeper, and the animals were trying to get out of the water. And then what happened was another deposit came in and buried sand on top of these footprints very quickly, so that the footprints were nicely preserved. There was no time for erosion. They didn't just walk along, you know, or swim along, make the footprints, and then just leave them there for, you know, days or weeks, you know, or any length of time. Very shortly after this event happened, a tremendous amount of mud and sand was brought in, buried these footprints, and made beautiful casts of them. All of that picture together suggests a rapid depositional environment, not a long gradual one. So there's another piece. Now we have turbidity currents, we have sandstone, we've got fossil reefs. All of them, when you look at them more closely, suggesting more rapid modes of deposition. Slowly but surely, it seems like hunks of the geologic column can be explained as rapid catastrophe and not by slow gradualism. This, again, by itself doesn't prove the flood or answer the questions, but it starts presenting data that can be more easily harmonized with a flood model or a catastrophic model than with a long, slow, gradualistic type of a model. Two more little illustrations. We have about 8 more minutes here before question time. The next one I'd like to share, just a few minutes, some research by a friend of mine named Dr. Paul Buchheim. Paul and I studied biology together originally at Pacific Union College. Then I went into archaeology, and he went into geology and got his PhD from the University of Wyoming. The interesting question that he chose to study for his dissertation was the formation of varves. I believe Dr. Baldwin made some reference to varves in his pictures this morning. Varves are, when you look at the Grand Canyon, you can see the stripes, the different color rocks on the side of the canyon. Okay, those are called strata. When you cut to the bottoms of some lakes today, you will see that the underneath the bottom of the lake, you look at the subsurface of the bottom, so to speak, you'll see a lot of thin layers there, sort of like a layered cake. There's many of them. They alternate light, dark bands. It looks sort of like a marble cake when you look at these lake bed deposits in cross-section. How do these varves form? Well, because they alternate light and dark, the conventional evolutionary explanation was that each pair of light and dark bands, or varves, or laminations, those words basically mean the same thing, they take 1 year to form. What would happen, they would suggest, is that in part of the year, the light band is being formed by the precipitation or the precipitation of chemicals out of the water. Forgive me for being a little technical here. Not as technical as it needs to be, but maybe technical enough. Certain chemicals would be floating in the water. They kind of fall out of the water and make a solid little band on the bottom of the lake. It creates a light-colored band of some chemicals called carbonates. The other half of the year, there's a lot of dead things floating around the lake, and these fall to the bottom of the lake. It's organic material, things that were formerly living, and they make a dark band. So half the year you've got light chemicals being deposited, the other half you've got dark organic material. Together a light-dark band would represent 1 year of time. They found a fossil lake, a dried-up lake out in Green River in Wyoming. And they saw, as they cut through the bottom of that lake, they saw that there were literally tens of thousands of varves there. Hundreds of thousands of varves. Well, you can see very easily what an evolutionary geologist would conclude. If you've got 100,000 varves, how many years is that? If they're paired varves, light-dark, okay? It's 100,000 years, right? If you've got 250,000 varves, how many years do you have? 250,000 years. So this was the assumption, how long it took this lake bottom to deposit. Again, that's kind of hard to put in a recent creation framework. So it represented a challenge. Dr. Buchheim decided to take that challenge up, and he started looking at this. He wondered, first of all, how do the varves form over 1 year's time? The general idea was that the lake would change its temperature, and that had during winter and summer, and that had an effect on the depositional rate, and it suggested that the water at the bottom of the lake in the summertime would go to the top of the lake in the winter, and the water at the top of the lake in the summer would go to the bottom of the lake in the winter, and this water kept circulating around, and this would contribute to the forming of the light dark varves. The problem with that theory, it required the existence of chemical anyway, it just popped out of my head, in the bottom of the lake for half a year. By the way, they found lots of dead fossil fish in these lakes, and the evolutionists had to explain how these fossil fish got down there. So when the poison would come to the top of the lake, it'd kill all the fish, and the fish would sink to the bottom, and then they would be buried. That was the evolutionary explanation for both creating the varves and all these millions, literally millions of fossil fish. The problem with that idea of poison moving up and down to the lake was that they found some catfish in the fossils. And catfish live all year round at the bottom of the lake. And the discovery of those catfish kind of shot a torpedo into the theory that the lake would have poison on it for half the year. You can't have catfish living down there for half the year in a poison environment. This was such a shocking discovery that when Dr. Buchheim made it, the magazine Geology, which is one of the major magazines for geologists, they published his discovery on their front cover. They published a picture of this catfish, which challenged the whole idea of the poison moving up and down in a yearly cycle. And they said, what are we going to do about this? I shouldn't say this, but Dr. Buchheim, he was so excited by this discovery because it overthrew this slow yearly, you know, depositional process for the formation of these varves. He put a penny right next to his fossil catfish, and it was turned to the side saying, in God we trust. There, just to, it was his little way of having this advertised on a major evolutionary journal. He continued his research into this, and he's gotten most of the discipline that deal with this type of geologic phenomena to recognize that apparently faster processes were going on, that the yearly processes don't work very well. One discovery he made was, if you look at these fossil fish, and there's millions of them, they're beautifully preserved. All of the bones are there, the rib bones, the backbones, the vertebra, even the eyes are preserved sometimes, the scales are found on the fish. So it seems that these fish were buried very quickly. How much time does it take to fossilize a fish? Or how long can a fish lay around and not rot before it needs to be buried so it can be fossilized? The Natural History Museum actually tried an experiment fossilizing fish. They took a bunch of freshly killed fish, this kind of thing scientists do, and they put them into some special containers. They went out to a lake and they put these containers under the mud in the bottom of this lake. It was kind of an open cage-like container so that water could flow in and out. But they kind of rammed it so that the mud would cover these fish in this kind of cage. The cage would hopefully keep predators out, so that they wouldn't come and nibble at the fish. They thought if the fish were somewhat protected, then maybe the skeletons would stay intact and we could see if this would be a mechanism for fossilizing the fish. Well, they put those fish down there and they came back 6 days later. Okay, and there was nothing particularly going on. They pulled the fish back up and they wanted to see what shape they were in. And they discovered that every one of the fish had totally fallen apart and decomposed. Yet you have in the bottom of this fossil lake millions of fish that are all perfectly preserved and not one bone is out of place. So this would suggest that it's a lot quicker than 6 days to bury these fish. You can't leave them around even 6 days. If they're exposed for 6 days, they will totally fall apart. So Dr. Buchheim presented that evidence. He showed a picture of a fossil vertebra of one of these fish, and he showed the barbs going up to the fish. And the fish was perfectly preserved, and there were about, 13 to 17 pairs of barbs going up to the backbone of the fish and going up and over the backbone. If the evolutionary perspective was true, that would mean that fish laid there for 17 years very happily and did not disintegrate on the bottom of the lake. And that would be impossible. When he made that discovery, he posted it on the graduate bulletin board at his university. He said, "Hey guys, how do you explain this?" And no one had any particular answer, good answer for that. So basically, Dr. Buchheim's research over 20 years has convinced a lot of geologists that at least in that area, these upper layers of the fossil record were laid down quickly. It's no longer thought that barbs take a year to be laid down. They can somehow lay down even more rapidly. One final story on that. Dr. Baldwin and I had the chance to go with Dr. Buchheim. A very unusual thing happened a few years ago. What was the name? It was Anson Breg Park. Paul Buchheim was down there doing some geological studies, and he was walking along a stream bed. And that year in California, sort of like this year, El Nino, there had been an unusual amount of rain. It's about, 8 years ago, John? A little more than that. And so as he was walking along the stream bed down the desert, he saw the water flowing down. That was very unusual. He does a lot of work there, and he's been out there for years, and you don't see any water running down these dry stream beds. But there was water coming down. And he thought, well, this is from the recent heavy rain that California's been having. So he started walking up this stream bed, and suddenly the water stopped flowing. And he thought, well, that's interesting. I happen to be here right at the moment when the stream dried up. And he kept walking up the stream bed, and suddenly the water started flowing again. Now, well, this is weird. It's like Old Faithful. It would flow and stop and flow and stop. It suddenly hit him as he was walking up, and you wonder if the Lord working with Paul here a little bit. But he thought, wait a minute, if this stream flows and stops and flows and stops, when it's flowing, it's going to be carrying mud down to a settlement basin. You know, the water is going to flow into a pond somewhere, some kind of a basin. So he said, well, when it's flowing, it's going to be carrying mud down, and that mud is going, the mud in the water is going to settle out in the bottom of this little pond. It's going to create a barb. When it stops flowing, it's going to quit creating a barb. When it starts flowing, it's going to create another barb on top of the one that was there before. So he waited a few weeks, and Dr. Baldwin and I happened to be visiting, and he said, how'd you like to go with me? Let's look at this dried up lake. It's a fresh one, not a fossil one. It's supposed to be hundreds of thousands of years old. Let's see what's in the bottom of this recent lake, how many barbs we can find there. So we went with him. The lake was all dry. Since we were the flunkies, Dr. Baldwin and I had the shovels, and I'm the archaeologist, so I had to teach them how to dig. So we dug some special trenches across the bottom of this lake, just like little archaeological, geological trenches, and we looked at the side of the trench, and sure enough, we found 1 meter, that's a little more than a yard, of perfect barbs hundreds and hundreds of bars that had all formed in just a few hours. And if you would have gone along with conventional interpretation, it would have taken them hundreds and hundreds of years to, create that little lake basin right there. So we found now in nature a mechanism that shows that barbs can, in some cases, be laid down even more rapidly. We're not sure that's the exact mechanism that worked in the Green River area back maybe in the late stages of the flood or after the flood, but it does show that there are things out there in nature that scientists hadn't thought of before that can create barbs much more rapidly. What was particularly fun for us, I said as an archaeologist, I said, you know, what would really clinch this, and we published this, is if we can find at the bottom of that meter of mud barbs that looks like it's a few thousand years old, if we could find a datable artifact, that would show it couldn't be thousands of years old. They might think we're lying. We come back and they'll think we have no proof. So I was just kind of kidding. I said, it would be wonderful to find a datable artifact. Well, we were just digging along in a trench, and Dr. Baldwin found a mayonnaise jar lid that some camper had left there. And we dug it up, and it said, good until, So we had a date at the bottom of these deposits so we could prove that these weren't hundreds or even, thousands of years old. They had indeed formed in just a few hours or days at most. So these kinds of things, again, just should caution the evolutionary world and give us a little bit of hope that there are processes we haven't thought of that can explain that, or suggest that things can form a lot more rapidly than we've appreciated in the past. My final one, and then we'll take a few minutes for questions. This to me is a very important one. I'm not a geologist. I've had a few courses in geology in my own training, but I think it's a very significant one. This is what Dr. Roth refers to as the absence of erosional features. The absence of erosional features. What in the world is that talking about? Well, to explain it as quickly and simply as I can, when you take an airplane and fly over the surface of the Earth, you can see the Earth is not, when you're way out in space, it looks like a marble. But when you're a little bit closer, we were just flying up to Seattle and down to California, you can see the Earth is very uneven. There are mountains, and there are great valleys, and there are places like the Grand Canyon. It's very uneven. Yet when you look at the strata in the geologic column, they're all very flat. Okay, they're all very even, but the current surface of the Earth is very uneven. You go to places like the Grand Canyon, you've got a hole in the earth that's a mile deep. Now, the interesting thing to me is when you go through the geologic column, if the world has been here for millions of years, the current Grand Canyon is a recent phenomenon. It's at the top of the geologic column. It's, even evolutionists say it only started forming just in the last few million years, couple of million years, and it took a little bit of time, a few hundred thousand years, a couple million years to erode that great big ditch out, okay? It's kind of a local thing. Now, if evolution were true and this world would last for another 100 million years, what would happen to the Grand Canyon? Well, according to current thought, it would gradually fill in. So you'd have a great big buried Grand Canyon, and then on top of that buried Grand Canyon, new sediments would be laid out. But if you were digging down through millions of years into the future, if you were to go into the past, you would see this buried Grand Canyon all filled in now and new sediments being laid on top. Well, when you go and look at the fossil or the geologic column anywhere else in the world, you would then expect to see occasionally in the past, like in the age of the dinosaurs, Grand Canyon should have been forming back then. As the dinosaurs were walking along the surface, there should have been mountains and Grand Canyons then. So we as scientists should be able to find old filled-in Grand Canyons. And the amazing thing is if you check the geologic literature, and Dr. Roth and some of his colleagues have done this, there is not one example, not one, of a serious build in erosional feature from the past. And the thing is, if evolution were true, there should be all sorts of filled in ancient fossil Grand Canyons, and they're not there. That would suggest that there hasn't been large amounts of time between the laying down of one layer and the laying down of another. If you lay down one layer and it stays exposed for long periods of time, it starts eroding. You'd start seeing all sorts of little canyons in it, and they'd be buried. But we're not finding that. Instead, these layers are all horizontal. This, to me, is another evidence that suggests there was not long periods of time. You know, the scientists would say, well, okay, here's a turbidity current. It comes quick, but then the thing sat there for 100,000 years, and then something else quick happened. That doesn't work because if it was sitting there for long periods of time, you should see lots of erosion. You don't see that in the geologic column. So these kinds of things, these are not the silver bullets, but these are the kinds of things we can look at that I think give a little bit of hope to creationists and to an examination for an alternative explanation for the origins of life on Earth, for the origins of geological features on the Earth. It gives me a little bit more confidence that perhaps God knew what he was talking about in Genesis, and it makes me focus on the worldwide flood as perhaps a different kind of a process for explaining a lot of the features that we see down there in the rocks below our feet. Okay, so that's what I wanted to share for a few minutes right now, and So we have... Okay, make sure I repeat the questions. We have about 5 minutes. If anyone has some questions or comments or reactions they'd like to share, gentlemen right there, please.
I noticed.
Yeah, some of the dinosaurs after. Okay, there are three questions there. We'll try and get them. The first is some of these claims recently. In fact, there's a book called The Gold of Exodus that claims that the correct location for Mount Sinai is in Saudi Arabia today at Jebel Lus. Or laws, it looks like laws almost in English. That view has been pushed not only by Larry Williams, I think you mentioned his name. I just saw that book for the first time a couple of days ago when I was up in Seattle. Also, Ron Wyatt has pushed that idea, and these folks that wrote this book, The Gold of the Exodus. The second question dealt with a long versus short sojourn. How long were the Israelites in Egypt? That's important in that it affects our biblical chronology by 215 years. That's not a lot of time when you're looking at millions of years or even, you know, for the age of the earth in a biblical perspective, but it still does affect the background, the proper background for historical events. And then the third question, I guess, dealt with could some animals from the flood have survived into the present? Those are all big questions, and I don't know if I can get into them in detail. This first one I want to answer very carefully on Jebel Lus and, you know, and Ron Wyatt, and I don't know Larry Williams well. He seems to be a nice fellow. I am a very, as you can gather, I'm a very conservative-oriented person. I love our Adventist truth, and I have a very high view of Scripture. At the same time, I'm trained as an archaeologist. For me, the Bible comes first, but after I've looked at the biblical evidence, then I go to, you know, what science has to tell me. In the case of a lot of the claims there, and this is, I always hate to say this because people are kind of disappointed, but the claims for this being Sinai, it could be. I don't have a problem with Sinai being somewhere other than St. Catharines. I've been at St. Catharines many times. It's an impressive mountain. There's nothing archaeologically. I know of at least 20 different mountains in Sinai, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia that have been proposed to be the true Mount Sinai. Okay, from what I've been able to investigate, none of them have conclusive proof. And my honest answer would have to be, I don't know for sure. I just don't know. I kind of like the traditional mountain, but it's only because it looks neat. Okay, and that's not a good scientific reason. It could be in Saudi Arabia. Now, a few of my colleagues and some non-Adventist colleagues, Frank Cross from Harvard University, he thinks it could be that the biblical evidence does seem to have some hints that it's located in Saudi Arabia. I just don't know for sure. But coming to the specific claim that Ron Wyatt has made, I looked at his video very closely. He shows a number of features in there, like walls, some big piled stones that look like an altar to him. And he shows petroglyphs with pictures of cows and animals on them. And he kind of, since they're all in one area and there's a mountain nearby, he suggests, could this be the place where the Ten Commandments were given? The altar was for the sacrifices, or the golden, and the animals on the petroglyphs represent the golden calf or sacrificial animals. My problem as an archaeologist is I see those features all over the Middle East. I travel quite a bit. I've done survey work. None of those things are unique to that particular location. So by themselves, they're not conclusive to me. I didn't see anything at that particular site that was compelling. I would say something, this isn't to criticize any, you know, buddy's friend here. I think we need to be very careful, particularly at Seventh-day Adventists, when we do go on explorations and investigations, to be honest and to be credible before the world. A few people, not mentioning names, I've been invited to participate in some ark hunting expeditions, looking for both Noah's Ark and for the Ark of the Covenant. But most of the people who have contacted me kind of do it in a clandestine fashion. And when I've asked them, well, why do you think it's there and what's your plan to get it out? It typically involves breaking the laws of various countries we're going to be going into. And I've always had a bit of a problem with that. Wouldn't it make wonderful headlines in USA Today? Seventh-day Adventists steal the Ark of the Covenant. You know, professor from Andrews University, Seventh-day Adventist school, stole the Ark of the Covenant. You know, right there, the Ten Commandments say, thou shalt not steal. Now, some people don't have a problem with that. If God tells them to do it, then it, you know, it's okay. Well, I agree. If God gives us a command, we have to follow it no matter what. But I somehow contradicts my understanding of God. He doesn't normally command us to break His own laws, I guess what I'm saying. So I have a little bit of a problem. My own feeling is if when God wants these things found, He'll do it in a way that is above board. There'll be no question about it. There will be no stories of, well, I saw it, but, you know, I can't show it to anybody else yet, or I lost the pictures, or I fell into a, you know, my friend fell into a canyon and died before he could tell us exactly. You know, I hear lots of stories like that, and I have a feeling if and when God wants these kinds of things found, it'll be very, very clear. So that's not a specific answer. That could be the site, but I didn't see anything there to suggest it must be Mount Sinai. On the second question, quickly, the 215 years, 430 years, Dr. Siegfried Horn, who I very much respected, he passed away a couple years ago, but he was my predecessor at the the Horn Archaeology Museum. We named it after him. Dr. Horn, in the Seventh-day Adventist Bible Commentary, he wrote that section on the sojourn, and he was of the opinion that it was 215 years. So he advocated what's called a short sojourn. So he dated Abraham and Joseph 215 years closer to the Exodus than people who advocate that the time the Israelites were in Egypt were 430 years. It is a linguistic problem with the text. There are some texts that seem to suggest 215, some suggest 430. It'd take too long to get into all the details. I personally, along with Dr. Bill Shea, favor the 430 years. That pushes Abraham back into a slightly earlier period and Joseph. And as I've looked at the archaeological background of that period, there are some events that occur in Egypt that line up very nicely with the story of Joseph in the Bible. But that's another whole talk that I don't have time to get. Now, I gave it to the young people this morning in Sabbath school. But there is an interesting event occurring in the time of the 12th dynasty, during the reign of Sesostris II and III, that fits beautifully with the Joseph story, and that would require the long sojourn. But the Bible by itself, I think, is... I don't want to say it's ambiguous, but it's not definite enough to be dogmatic about it. And then on the final questions, could animals have survived from the flood? I think many animals did survive. We don't have any definite proof, but to me, it's possible. That's not a satisfactory. I'm not being very specific, but I think there could have been some animals survived. I don't know, though, of any surviving dinosaurs right now or anything like that that I can speak to. Okay, maybe this afternoon later we'll have some time for some other questions. These got more archaeological than they did geological.
This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.